my radio program, which consisted of two short statements of support from Cosby daughters Erin and Ensa, and a lengthy interview that Erin recorded with her father. Would I like to play some of the sound on my radio show, they asked? Maybe, was my reply. I wasn't about to commit to just playing sound that I hadn't heard and suspected was biased in support of Cosby, but what did interest me, I said, was to interview Bill Cosby himself. To my surprise, Wyatt and Cosby told me that was possible. The following Monday at noon, I taped a 30-minute interview with Cosby, which aired the following day, May 16, uncut and uninterrupted by commercials on my SiriusXM radio show. I prepared for the interview as I would a deposition, and with the knowledge that merely speaking with him would earn me scorn. It did. My intention was to be fair but direct, courteous but not a lackey, and mostly to let him talk. The biggest revelation was Cosby telling me he had no intention of taking the stand in his own defense, quote, no I do not, unquote. While I'd seen plenty of news footage showing Cosby slowly entering the courthouse to face charges for aggravated indecent assault, the man I spoke with, possessing an unmistakable, hearty laugh, was not mentally infirm. He told me that he regarded himself as, quote, unsighted, unquote, but his 79-year-old mind was sharp. And though his answers were often meandering, he nevertheless made his points. He dismissed my question as to whether he was seeking to influence jurors, quote, you can't aim at jurors, unquote, but maintained his eye on his goal, quote, well, things were rescinded, and I'd like to get those things back, unquote. He was particularly accepting of daughter Ensa's opinion that there is racism at play. Quote, could be, I can't say anything, but there are certain things that I look at and I apply to the situation. There are so many tentacles, so many different, nefarious is a great word, and I just truly believe that some of it may very well be that, unquote. And said he'd been subjected to media bias. Quote, I also feel that there are many film things in writing as well that people can take what you say and insert it, and it will mean something altogether different, unquote. He presented himself as a victim of a gang up by accusers. Quote, I think that the numbers came because the numbers prior to the numbers didn't work, unquote. And not only intent to deny him the reputation he has earned, but willing to punish those still willing to pay to watch him perform. Quote, but I will ask this question. If no matter what happens, if a man is then free to go where he wants to go, free within the law to do what he wants to do, and he offers himself in concert for people to buy tickets, why would people threaten the hall, threaten the people who book the show, when in fact the people who are coming are those who are buying the tickets? Unquote. The conversation got huge play. Patrick Riley, the head of corporate communications for SiriusXM, distributed an internal email calling the pickup of the interview, quote-unquote, massive. I'll say. He reported that in the ensuing 48 hours, the audience for the national television segments discussing the interview totaled nearly 20 million viewers. In addition, the interview also played on local news outlets in more than 100 cities across the country. There were many headlines generated by the interview. As I explained in a subsequent Sunday Inquirer column, quote, many outlets like the Inquirer and Washington Post highlighted that Cosby revealed he would not testify in his own behalf. Several, including the Huffington Post, noted that he regarded the volume of accusers as, quote unquote, piling on. Others, like People magazine, reported that he had said he, quote unquote, never lost the support of his wife. All of that is true. But to me, who conducted the interview, they missed the bigger takeaway from the discussion. Considered in total, the half-hour conversation was a roadmap of Cosby's defense. At the end of the interview, Cosby said, quote, I just hope I'm not in trouble now, man, unquote, which itself generated a headline from the New York Post. I thought his concern justified, given that he'd invoked race and revealed his trial posture. I'm not sure he helped me personally when within hours of the airing of the interview, he tweeted me thanks for, quote, integrity, ethics, and clarity, unquote. But it was clear that he believed he'd made his points. 1 month later, a mistrial was declared when the Cosby jury could not agree on the verdict in his case. Air travel screening stupidity times four. Philadelphia Daily News, March 10, 2005. I'm prepared to crown a winner. Of what you ask, my competition for best horror story involving airport security screening since 9/11. In the 6 months since I published Flying Blind, How Political Correctness Continues to Compromise Airline Safety, I've been overwhelmed with anecdotes from all over about the ridiculous nature of passenger screening. I've heard it all. Military folks returning from the front lines in uniform and with papers who take a commercial flight only to get searched after being selected for random screening. Or people with pacemakers and documents that say metal detectors might cause a heart hiccup who are nevertheless wanded and asked what they're hiding in their chest. I've heard from eyewitnesses to the full-scale screening of government leaders like Senator Joseph Lieberman and former Secretary of Defense William Cohen. There's been the full complement of seniors with walkers and young kids on whom we've wasted precious resources. But none compares to the experience of the Yoakum family from Booth Wynn on October 28, 2002 at the Phoenix Airport. Frank and Claire Yoakum's visit to Arizona was due to her quadruple pregnancy. The plan was to deliver at Good Samaritan Hospital in Phoenix because that's the home to Dr. John P. Elliott, nationally recognized for his delivery of quadruplets. Claire's delivery was 9 weeks premature. The babies then needed 2 months in the ICU. Their immune systems were compromised, and they had to be kept germ-free. A cold could have killed them. The Yoakums were eager to return to Pennsylvania. Their doctors were nervous about the travel. Airplanes with their recycled air are not the most sanitary of environments. After consulting the physicians and American West Airlines, they decided to make the trip on a late-night flight when there would be few other passengers. American West was so sympathetic, it offered to fly the entire family free. So sensitive was the situation that the Yoakums had to take CPR training before the hospital would permit the travel. Frank Yoakum, a cop's son, was meticulous about planning for the journey. The morning of the flight, he actually made a test run so he knew exactly where to go, minimizing the baby's contact with other people. On the day of the flight, the nurses and doctors prepared the Yoakums for their 7-hour trip. They organized bottles, medicines, and other necessities, extremely important because the babies were all on different formulas. Each of the babies was on a heart monitor, and the darkness of the night flight was expected to make the necessary maneuvering quite a challenge. The trip from the hospital to the airport was smooth until it came to airport screening. By now, I'm sure you've guessed that the newborn Yoakum quads were selected for additional screening. 19 Arab lookalikes wreaked havoc on the United States on 9/11, and four newborns from Philadelphia are the ones getting the hairy eyeball. The babies, wrapped tight in blankets with a net covering their safety seats, were removed from their medical equipment and searched. All of their bags, prepared and organized by the nurses, had to be removed. Worst of all, the screeners woke the sleeping babies. Frank and Claire never again got a handle on the situation, and the flight home was chaos. Everything was thrown back into bags to sort out later, which never happened. Unlike the screeners, the other passengers had common sense. They voluntarily moved to the front of the plane and gave the Yoakums about 20 rows to themselves. Says Frank, quote, "I can only imagine what it was like for the other passengers with four crying babies and heart monitors going off on a 5-hour flight," unquote. A member of Congress recently told me the TSA has backed off the random screening of children, but when I tried to confirm this with the TSA, they reported no change in policy. TSA says the policy of selecting passengers for secondary screening by the individual air carriers occurs in one of two ways: random selection by the carrier or selection based on a screening profile that looks for, quote-unquote, trends in travel. Children under 12 who are selected randomly may be, quote-unquote, deselected at the carrier's discretion, and a parent need not be screened in place of the child. The stupidity continues. I'm happy to report that the Yoakum quadruplets and their parents are doing well. During the 2016-2017 school year, the now 14-year-old Claire, Frank, Jake, and Judy were all honor students in the eighth grade at Garnet Valley Middle School. Father Frank confirmed that all four kids are, quote-unquote, very healthy, which seems like a miracle, given their susceptible immune systems as babies. Frank went on to tell me more about each kid, including, quote, Claire plays field hockey and lacrosse for the school team, but Judy runs track and cross country. The girls wanted to do separate sports, but are inseparable otherwise. Jake is 6 feet tall and is crazy about politics and is Hillary Clinton's biggest supporter. Frank plays baseball and basketball for the school team and loves sports, unquote. Meanwhile, Mom went back to work as a gifted teacher in the Chichester School District less than 2 years after the children were born. Understandably, Dad is concerned about college. Postcard from Gladwin, Philadelphia Daily News, July 28, 2005. You think you have issues in the city? Be glad you're not out here on the main line this summer. It's a jungle. In case you haven't heard, Bill and Laura just got news that their lease isn't being renewed, which means they're getting the boot by the end of the summer from the shack that Laura runs with Doris, unless things change, and that's unlikely because Connie owns the place and he's committed to Maurice so that Maurice can expand his salon into what's now the kitchen, which has everybody angry. In fact, there's a website up called SaveTheLunch.com where you can find talk of boycotting OMG and, as if that's not enough, when a local reporter went to Connie for comment about throwing out Bill and Laura, he says Connie mumbled something about home invasion and brandished a pistol. It's enough to make you want to move back into the city. Bill and Laura Faust own Gladwin Village Lunch. They have terrific, inexpensive food, basic stuff hard to find out here, where even short-order cooks think of themselves as artistes. Eggs with pork roll, BLTs, cheesesteaks. Even SOS in the colder months. Laura won't make it in the summer, although I've never dared ask why. I never got around to asking her anything until the controversy began. That was the beauty of the place. You could go in, eat, and be left alone if you chose. But now everyone who stops by is conversing, mostly about Maurice next door, and Connie down the block. Maurice is Maurice Tannenbaum, the hairstylist to the rich and famous in these parts. He once shaved my head. I'd had a few drinks at the guardhouse and finally decided to do it. Maurice obliged. It cost me a C-note. I always say that if Bill Clinton stopped traffic for a haircut out here, no doubt it would be Maurice with the shears in his hands. His salon is called OMG, as in, oh my God, I couldn't make this stuff up. Needless to say, Maurice is a character. He drives a yellow Hummer 0.6 mile to work from the home that he shares with his significant other, John, according to his website. He says that when he arrived in Gladwin, Bill Faust was rude to him. In the same post, which began, don't hate me because I'm beautiful, he also said that the gardening rigs and delivery trucks caused the traffic jams on the block, not his clients with their BMWs and Porsches. Which gets to the heart of this controversy. Maurice's clients do drive fancy cars, and while I suspect that most of Maurice's customers eat at Village, I doubt many Village customers reciprocate. Some of the Village customers drive fancy cars too, but many also command those gardening rigs. All are equal at Gladwin Village Lunch. Smack dab in the middle of one of the 50 richest zip codes in America are 6 highly coveted bar stools open to anyone. On them you will find the fannies of cops, accountants, lawyers, doctors, mechanics, grocers, landscapers, retirees, and school kids. Joe is the guy who checks my oil at Gladwin Texaco, but he is a salt shaker away from me at breakfast. Think Famous Deli without the politicians. Memories get made here. Parents with their kids, kids who return with their kids. Bill and Laura have run it for about a decade of its 60 years. The building was the first post office for Gladwin's predecessor, Marion Square, back in the Civil War era, which is why it will be a crime if it closes. I've asked Maurice to reconsider. No way. He intends to open OM Gorgeous, a tiny day spa, just what the area doesn't need. Maurice also told me that Connie Barker, who owns the shack and the block on which it stands, would just find somebody else. When Richard Ilgenfritz of the Mainline Times went to Barker to find out if this was true, he said Barker pulled out a pistol, although he made it clear that Barker didn't point it at him. I believe Ilgenfritz. He's an ex-Marine and has seen guns before. Barker is another local character, which is all the more reason that the place should stay open. We characters need a clubhouse. Six stools. I'm picturing Maurice, another for his partner John, Laura and Bill, one for Connie, and one for yours truly. Maybe I'm dreaming. Gladwin Village Lunch ended up moving less than a half a block up to 951 Youngsford Road into what had previously been the Marion Square Coiffure. About a month after this column ran, I took a copy that I'd had framed and presented it to Laura as a bit of a housewarming gift, thinking that she would hang it in the new location. When she didn't, after a few weeks, I asked why. She said that she was so angry about what had happened to the old spot that she refused to post a visual reminder in the new luncheonette. Bill and Laura decided to retire in 2011 and move to Florida after 18 years of owning and operating Gladwin Village Lunch. They sold the restaurant to one of their patrons, Gladwin resident Sam Stanford, who renamed the spot the Gladwin Lunch Box. Sam subsequently sold it to Theo Jarek, who remains the owner, and I'm still a customer. I recommend the tuna scoop salad for lunch. Good with a pen, as well as a football. Philadelphia Daily News, August 11, 2005. It was 30 years ago, but I remember it like it was yesterday. I rode my yellow banana seat bicycle, the one with monkey handlebars, the three blocks from my house to the Arctic Market in Doylestown. It was a Saturday and an important day in the neighborhood. A new Philadelphia Eagles wide receiver was coming to town, and those of us who imitated our favorite Eagles when we played Nerf football on Mercer Avenue were excited to meet him. I remember our awe when he walked in the same door we'd usually enter with our folks and shopping carts. He was a giant. There was 6'8" of him. But he wasn't intimidating, not even to young kids half his size. He had a disarming smile and a gentle nature. He was gracious, and he was accommodating. He seemed to understand and appreciate that it was a very big deal for my friends and me to have the chance to shake his hand and ask him to sign his picture. His name was Harold Carmichael. There were a handful of us neighborhood kids who showed up that day to get his autograph and be present for a grand prize drawing. As luck would have it, number 17 pulled my name out of a hat, and I won a pair of tickets to an Eagles preseason game at Veterans Stadium. I remember being thrilled and a little embarrassed, but very anxious to share the news with my parents. When I didn't have a dime to call home from the payphone outside, the big guy himself reached into his pocket and gave me one. I guess that's why I never stopped cheering for Harold Carmichael. On and off the field, he was what little kids thought pro football players were made of. I was thinking about my encounter with Harold Carmichael this past Monday when reading about the kids with their fathers who showed up last Sunday at Lehigh expecting that T.O. would sign autographs as per the Eagles player signing schedule. To me, it's inexcusable that T.O. stood them up. Off the field, T.O. is no Harold Carmichael. Up until this point, I haven't had a rooting interest for or against T.O. in his attempt to breach his contract with the Birds. He says he's worth more than the negotiated amount he is to receive in an agreement which still has wet ink. I keep wondering if that means he's willing to refund the Eagles if he underperforms. We all know the answer to that one. But now I feel different. T.O. crosses the line when he disrespects fathers and sons, kids like I was 3 decades ago at the Arctic Market, who make the drive to the Lehigh Valley with an expectation of getting his autograph at a designated place and an appointed time. Frankly, he's not worthy of their admiration. Instead, he's everything bad that sports have become. He's a big, spoiled, petulant, pain in the ass. And I can't understand why everyone in this town is so afraid to say so. Yes, he can catch. So could Harold. And Harold could sign autographs, too. This reflection on celebrity reminds me of another column I wrote in 2003 for the Daily News. I recounted a night spent in Camden, New Jersey, in the company of two disparately famous characters, Pete Rose and Ted Nugent. I had been invited to Campbell's Field, the beautiful home of the River Sharks, to introduce Pete Rose to thousands of fans there to watch his number 14 being retired in a minor league ballpark. The greatest baseball player of our time didn't know my role as we mingled at a pregame event. And what a sight he was. His close-cropped Moe haircut, an unnatural shade of orange, a pair of sweats that would make a South Philly gangster proud, gold chain with alligator clips suspending a pair of eyeglasses, you get the picture. My buddy Paul Lauricella had a great line, quote, "Pete Rose now looks like what you'd get if James Caan and Pete Rose had a baby." What would ever lead you to conclude that he had a gambling problem, unquote. Unfortunately, Pete was really an ass. He refused to sign anything other than the paid-for pictures he was peddling, including the baseball I'd carried to the game, a one-time foul ball I'd snagged in that same stadium. He only changed his tune when we met again under the concourse, and he saw me with a microphone in my hand and realized my role just before we walked onto the field. A few minutes later, and a couple of blocks away, I stood backstage with Motor City Madman Ted Nugent. Quite a contrast. Hair down to his butt, guitar in his hand, guns on his mind. Nugent was thrilled to put his pen to my copy of Kill It and Grill It, which you could call his recipe for life. I wrote in the column that Nugent was, quote, much more the embodiment of the American dream than Rose. The rocker owes his place to hard work, and he didn't screw up along the way. Rose's legacy may have been born in America's pastime, but he no longer conjures up visions of hot dogs and apple pie. Nugent, on the other hand, has distinguished himself by being an unabashed flag waver who is stone cold sober in an industry of antagonists and miscreants, unquote. Years later, I became disgusted with Nugent's vitriol, quote unquote, subhuman mongrel, directed at President Obama. But that night in Camden, he was the better man. Small gesture for a real American hero. Philadelphia Daily News, September 15, 2005. Jose Melendez Perez, one of the great unsung heroes of 9/11, felt a room full of brotherly love last week. Arguably, it's Melendez we can thank for the fact that Flight 93 never completed its mission of striking a symbol of democracy in Washington and instead crashed into a field in western Pennsylvania. Melendez was feted at a luncheon in his honor, sponsored by my radio station, the Big Talker 1210, at the Union League. A confab of conservative Republicans? Not exactly. Particularly when Representative Bob Brady, head of the city Democrats, stood up to present Melendez with a flag he flew in his honor over the Capitol and thank Melendez for saving his life. Still, no amount of recognition could ever fully thank Melendez for what he did while performing his job back on August 4, 2001. It was Melendez, an immigration inspector, who stopped Mohammed Al-Qahtani when he tried to enter the United States at Orlando International Airport. Qahtani was a Saudi national who was directed to Melendez because he had incorrectly filled out a customs declaration. Qahtani claimed not to speak English. Melendez put Qahtani into his computer, and it came up negative. His documents seemed genuine. A check of his possessions was unremarkable. But Melendez still didn't let him pass. Why? Quote, "My job requires me to know the difference between legitimate travelers to the U.S. and those who are not," he told the 9/11 Commission. "This included potential terrorists," unquote. Keep in mind, this is a month before 9/11. Quote, "Through my INS training and military experience, my first impression of the subject was that he was a young male, well-groomed, with short hair, trimmed mustache, black long-sleeve shirt, black trousers, black shoes. He was about 5'6" and in impeccable shape with large shoulders and thin waist. He had a military appearance. Upon establishing eye contact, he exhibited body language and facial gestures that appeared arrogant. In fact, when I first called his name in the secondary room and matched him with papers, he had a deep, staring look, unquote. As Melendez would later tell the commission, quote, he just gave me the creeps, unquote. And the would-be terrorist who claimed not to speak English suddenly was able to say when Melendez rejected him, quote, I'll be back, unquote. The next time that we encountered Qahtani, he was fighting in Afghanistan. He's now at Guantanamo. Here's the kicker. What we now know is that at the moment that Mohammed al-Qahtani was being given his walking papers by Melendez at the Orlando airport, there to pick up the new arrival was 9/11 ringleader Mohammed Atta. That was one of the more interesting details to emerge from the work of the 9/11 Commission, and why Democratic 9/11 Commissioner Richard Benveniste told Melendez that his conduct may have spared the Capitol or White House an attack. Benveniste reasoned that with the added muscle of Qahtani on Flight 93, the terrorists could have fended off the passenger revolt and continued toward Washington. No wonder Bob Brady wanted to thank Melendez, and that City Councilman Frank Rizzo was present to extend recognition from the city, and that State Representative Denny O'Brien did likewise from the Commonwealth. Alice Hoagland, mother of Flight 93's Mark Bingham, sent a greeting from California. Deborah Burlingame, sister of Chick Burlingame, pilot of American Flight 77, which crashed into the Pentagon, and Ellen Saracini, wife of Victor Saracini, captain of United Flight 175, which hit the South Tower, both came to extend their gratitude. From the moment that Lauren Hart sang the national anthem, it was one of those events that no written description will ever be able to fully describe. And when it was finally time for Melendez to address the crowd, he choked back tears and told the crowd, quote, I wish my father were here to see this, unquote. Jim Murray, the former Eagles GM and founder of the Ronald McDonald House, then stood to offer a benediction. Murray paused and said, quote, Jose, your father was watching today, unquote. There were no dry eyes. Jose retired in October of 2013 after 40 years of service to his country. He spent his last 15 months on the job teaching a basic course for new Customs and Border Patrol officers at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia. He has since shared with me that he greatly enjoyed aiding the development of new officers, but I wonder whether the skills he possessed aren't innate versus something one can be taught. My hunch is that Jose was born with a gift for reading people, an instinct, which was the word that I used when I wrote a book about him in 2009. We donated all proceeds from Instinct to the Flight 93 National Memorial in Shanksville. He also said that while he was reluctant to hang up his uniform, his retirement life is great. Having successfully fought cancer, he now spends his time on home projects, some travel, and enjoying time with family and friends. He has two sons and two daughters. One son has retired as a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, and another is a police officer in Puerto Rico. Every time there's a terror incident anywhere in the world, his mind drifts back to that day, 1 month in advance of 9/11, on which he altered the course of history. Duke Case, Revenge of the Nerds. Philadelphia Daily News, April 13, 2006. When I was a college freshman a quarter century ago, rape charges were brought against virtually every guy who lived in the fraternity housing the football team. The story was huge news. I watched as about two dozen guys had their lives turned upside down by one woman who claimed that they had all raped her. They were all exonerated a few years later, but by then it had faded to a B-section story. No page one for that. I see the same thing happening at Duke. The press coverage is totally one-sided against the lacrosse players and in support of the, quote, victim. You have to search for anything resembling investigative journalism concerning the accuser. For example, this tidbit was aired Friday on WRAL-TV in Raleigh, North Carolina, but given scant attention elsewhere. Quote, new information about the victim has been divulged. According to a 2002 police report, the woman, currently a 27-year-old student at North Carolina Central University, gave a taxi driver a lap dance at a Durham strip club. Subsequently, according to the report, she stole the man's car and led deputies on a high-speed chase that ended in Wake County. Apparently, the deputy thought that the chase was over when the woman turned down a dead-end road near Briar Creek, but instead, she tried to run him over, according to the police report. Additional information notes that her blood alcohol level registered at more than twice the legal limit. In spite of that incident, her lawyer at the time, Woody Van, asserted that the incident should not cause people to question her character. He said she is, quote, a decent and credible human being. Just imagine if it came to light that one of the lacrosse players had received a lap dance and stolen a taxi and tried to run over a cop. Page one again, all the way from Durham to Philadelphia. The DNA results, negative. No match between the DNA taken from the 46 white athletes and the samples taken from the exotic dancer's body or belongings. And photos from the party have come to light. In one, the victim is smiling at the camera. In another, she's lying down on the back porch of the house. Most controversial, the timestamp photos indicate the woman was bruised on her legs and face and had cuts on her legs, knees, and feet when she came to the party before the rape allegedly occurred. It was in July of 2003 that Kobe Bryant was accused of rape after having what he considered a consensual encounter with an employee at a Colorado hotel. Bryant was crucified in the media while the victim went unnamed and unsupported by evidence. DNA in this case showed that she had a sexual encounter with someone else shortly after she was with Bryant. A judge finally dismissed the case a year later, but Bryant paid heavily with loss of reputation and lucrative endorsements. We've just seen a similar case more recently right here, that of Gary Neal and Michael Cleaves. In June of 2004, these basketball players from LaSalle were charged with having sexually assaulted and raped a woman, 19, over a bathroom sink while she was heavily intoxicated and throwing up. The, quote, victim had left a party and met players attending summer classes on campus who invited her back to their house. The unnamed woman admitted to downing 8 shots of high-proof booze in 1 hour. She started to feel sick and went to the bathroom. Her blood alcohol content was a whopping 0.23. The woman admitted never saying no or offering real resistance. As the case raged on, prosecutors contended that she was too drunk to consent to sex. Defenders claimed that the sex was consensual and the woman created the allegation out of embarrassment. In November, a jury acquitted both men of all charges. These cases share the characteristics of race, gender, and perhaps most important, social standing. The question, what drives this hostility toward athletes? Why a rush to judgment every time a ball player is accused of sexual indiscretions? I say it's revenge of the nerds. Most journalists would never be chosen for a pickup game of hoops, let alone a varsity sport. So they take perverse pleasure in bringing down the BMOC, however undeserved. What went on in the Kobe case and at LaSalle and now at Duke, the unathletic are getting their chance to vent at those who are. And they crucify these young men with gleeful speed. While the victims are allowed to remain anonymous and aren't prosecuted for their tales, the athletes they accuse don't get the same treatment. These young men are the real victims. No quotation marks needed. I was skeptical about the Duke lacrosse case from day one and said so both on radio and in print. The investigation began a day after the alleged incident on March 14, 2006, but the story broke wide open on March 29. That morning, the New York Times put the burgeoning scandal on its front page, and I read the story aloud on my radio program, voicing my reservations about the quickly spreading narrative of a gang rape by boorish athletes. In the article, Durham County District Attorney Michael B. Nifong criticized team members for their lack of cooperation. Quote, the thing that most of us found so abhorrent and the reason I decided to take it over myself was the combination gang-like rape activity accompanied by the racial slurs and general racial hostility, unquote. How could he be so sure, I wondered. I would later have similar doubts about the alleged gang rape of a co-ed in a University of Virginia fraternity, which ended up a hoax. Part of my skepticism stemmed from my recollection of a separate incident that I distinctly recall at the beginning of this column. In the spring of 1981, I was a second semester freshman at Lehigh University. That April, 14 men, including 13 Lehigh University students, were charged with the rape of a 19-year-old woman from a neighboring college, Muhlenberg. They were members of a fraternity, Delta Tau Delta, a football house, which was immediately suspended for 4 years, during which time it was converted into co-ed student housing. One of the guys, a 20-year-old, was from my hometown, and his name, like all the others, was sprayed across the local newspapers. Ultimately, they were all exonerated for rape. 9 were cleared before trial, and 1 was admitted to an accelerated rehabilitation program for the charge of open lewdness. 4 went to trial and were acquitted, but the damage was already done to their reputations. And even though the case occurred in a pre-social media world, I still had no trouble recently accessing the old newspaper accounts via Google. Don't get me wrong, guys can be pigs, and sexual assault is a real problem on American campuses. Those who take liberties need to be severely punished. But equally inviolable must be the rule of law, which affords the accused the presumption of innocence. Due to his handling of the Duke lacrosse case, Nifong was ultimately disbarred, and the accuser, Crystal Mangum, while never facing legal repercussions for her false allegations in the Duke case, was arrested for attempted murder of her live-in partner in 2010. She was later convicted of lesser charges, and in 2013 was convicted of second-degree murder in connection with the 2011 stabbing death of her boyfriend, for which she is serving a 14- to 18-year prison sentence. Setting the record straight, Philadelphia Daily News, May 18, 2006. Dear Wilson, congratulations on receiving your first Holy Communion today. It brought a tear to my eye to stand with you as you accepted the sacrament, and it was obvious to your mother and me that you have taken your religious education very seriously. I saved a copy of the church bulletin distributed at Mass today as a keepsake, and I'm writing this letter in the hope that you'll keep it attached to the bulletin as an explanation. You see, my name appears in an insert to the bulletin distributed throughout the archdiocese on the day that you received communion, and not in a favorable light. The situation caught me by surprise. It was unsettling to sit in a pew as we prepared for your special moment, only to look at the flyer and see my name under the banner of a group called Pro-Life Union, Inc. They mentioned my name in a story about a recent symposium at Penn. At the invitation of bioethicist Arthur Kaplan, I participated and posed questions to experts on the subject of death and dying. But the assertion that I was at Penn to quote-unquote celebrate the death of a woman named Terry Schiavo was untrue. I found that characterization offensive. While I refuse to let it mar your day, it warrants an explanation. Terry Schiavo was a woman who collapsed without warning in 1990 at age 26. She never recovered. Her husband Michael discovered her at their home in the early morning after hearing a thud. She was later diagnosed to be in persistent vegetative state. 2 years after the event, Michael successfully asserted a malpractice action against Terry's doctors for failing to diagnose an underlying eating and nutritional disorder that led to her cardiac arrest and caused irreversible brain damage. While the jury made financial awards in a number of areas, medical expenses, lost earnings, loss of consortium, they awarded nothing for Terry's pain and suffering. In other words, after hearing the evidence just 2 years after the tragedy, the jury concluded that Terry was then feeling no pain and not suffering. Soon afterward, there came an ugly battle between Michael and Terry's parents, the Schindlers. The judge in this dispute concluded that it was about money from the malpractice action, but it soon morphed into a battle over Terry's end-of-life wishes since she could no longer speak for herself. On this issue, there was a factual dispute between Michael and the Schindlers. A court listened to evidence for 5 days and determined that Terry's wish was to disconnect her feeding tube. The appeals process upheld that view. Things got ugly. Many outsiders tried to affect the outcome. One of those was the pro-life community, which embraced Terry's parents and voiced opposition to taking away her feeding tube. I supported the right of the individual to have her wishes fulfilled. I regarded Terry's case as one involving the right of a person to die on her own terms. I believe that the affected person could make the decision free of any outside involvement, including the government's. I never looked at Terry's case in the conventional pro-life versus pro-choice terms, but as the dispute continued, I began to wonder whether the pro-life agenda was to support life even in a situation where someone in a permanent vegetative condition would want otherwise. Terry Schiavo left this earth in 2005. An autopsy showed that she was in a permanent vegetative state, had been for many years, and that the cause of her death was brain damage due to anoxic brain injury. An inquiry by a Florida state's attorney found an absence of any evidence that her initial collapse was caused by criminal actions. I wish my name had not appeared in the church bulletin on the day of your first communion. I love our church and the fulfillment it has provided each member of our family. But I am your father first, and I am not about to let this moment pass without providing you with a frame of reference for how your dad views the controversy, even though I recognize it will be inappropriate for you to read this for a number of years. Let no one tell you that your father celebrated any death. Your old man is supportive of self-determination. In the case of Terry Schiavo, I kept saying, "There but for the grace of God go I." If that outcome should come my way, I certainly don't want some individual or group, pro-life or pro-choice, imposing their view of end-of-life issues on me or anyone else. The fact that one such group would proclaim in a church bulletin on the day of your first Holy Communion that I celebrated death by my support of Terry Schiavo's right to determine her own fate tells me all I need to know about this group's lack of respect for individual rights. They wanted to call this shot for Terry. Well, please don't let them ever decide for me. Love, Dad. There is one aspect of the Terry Schiavo case about which all should agree. Everyone needs to specify their own end-of-life wishes. I'll support anyone's individual desire, and I will oppose those interlopers who seek to overturn another's desire. After Schiavo passed away on March 31, 2005, in lieu of a typical column, on April 7, 2005, I instead published a pro forma Pennsylvania standard living will that I'd filled out for myself. I encourage readers to copy the format I had published or send me a self-addressed stamped envelope in which I'd return a standard version for their usage. After 15 years and more than 1,000 columns, that remains one of my most popular. Months later, people were still asking me for a sample living will. I'd like to think I spared someone the family squabble that was the hallmark of the Schiavo case. A Dog Named Winston, Philadelphia Daily News, June 6, 2006. In the late 1980s, I had a humiliating experience. I was trying to make my way as a real estate developer when the market collapsed. I was overextended with several Center City properties. I was on the brink of filing for bankruptcy. My only hope was to arrange a deal with my bank, First Executive, then headed by an amiable Israeli named Zvi Muscal. In advance of our sit-down, he had asked for an itemization of my monthly living expenses. In my moment of truth, there sat Zvi, with furrowed brow and oversized glasses at the end of his nose, bearing down on my list. His finger had been running over the page when it stopped on one item. What was it, I wondered? My cable bill, American Express, Pico, the Union League fees. Michael, he asked in his very heavy accent, what is this dog-walking expense of $15 per day? Of all of the money flowing out of my pocket, my banker thought that paying a woman to come to my apartment and walk my young cocker spaniel Winston was my most extravagant expense. Little did he know that I'd have sooner gotten rid of the TV set, cut off the power, or quit the Union League than deprive my little guy of a leg stretch while I was at work. Zvi and I still joke about my refusal to budge on that expense. I'm thinking a lot about that and other memories of Winston because I had to bury him this weekend. He died suddenly on Sunday morning after living a very full 16 years. His life was amazing, considering all that he went through. Not that it makes it any easier for me to grieve. My wife told me, I've given myself an impossible task if my goal is to try to express to you the meaning of his life and our time together. She's right. Too many others have done too good of a job explaining that bond between people and their pets, not the least of whom is John Grogan in Marley and Me. Still, if my alternative subjects today are flag burning, an Iraq exit strategy, Santorum versus Casey, or next year's mayoral race, I'd rather tell you about Winston. He's way more interesting. Getting Winston was the suggestion of a long-ago girlfriend. I'd never had a dog and was leery of the responsibility. In fact, I decided to bring him home only when the breeder told me he was born on Christmas. But that's not the real divine intervention. This is. Soon after the girlfriend was gone and my wife entered the picture, she too had a cocker named Rudy. We quickly established that Rudy and Winston were brothers, having been bought from the same breeder at the same time. But Winston's Christmas birth was thrown into doubt when my wife told me that the breeder, thinking she was Jewish, told her that Rudy was born in the middle of Hanukkah. Winston was to become a walking advertisement for managed care. For a while, he was a regular at the Penn Vet School ER, making me wish I hadn't scoffed at a brochure offering health insurance for pets during his first visit. During his life, he'd require eye surgery, a urethrotomy, and a hip realignment by the nation's foremost dog orthopedist after he was hit by a truck. He also needed emotional therapy for separation anxiety, not that I think even Blue Cross has a plan that would have covered that. There was also the afternoon he cornered a baby bunny in our backyard. He had it in his jowls and must have panicked when I shouted, because down the hatch went the bunny. This too necessitated a trip to Penn, where on X-ray the bones of Brer Rabbit were discernible. And those were the real problems, not the false alarms, like the night that he woke me up from a dead sleep with what I thought were convulsions. Imagine my embarrassment over at Penn when they told me he had a severe case of the hiccups. My love for him was such that I went to great lengths to try to breed him. That too was an eye-opener. First, my wife and I took him to a dog show at Ludwig's Corner, naively thinking that we'd match our prized possession with someone else's. But the dog Nazis at the show demeaned the length of his ears, the shape of his nose, and the size of his belly. So we implemented Plan B, a personal ad titled Sleepless in Philadelphia, giving an honest approximation of his physical attributes. That, too, was a loser. No replies. Finally, we found an evangelical Christian from Lancaster who said she'd let Winston have a go with her Tootsie as long as we paid $1,200. Praying that Zvi the banker wouldn't find out, we made the deal. Then fate dealt Winston a most unkind blow. 2 weeks before his date with Tootsie, we were down the shore and noticed he wasn't peeing. A quick trip to the vet revealed that he had a kidney stone in his bladder. Or as our then 6-year-old daughter put it, Winnie has a rhinestone in his platter. I'm left with lots of memories, too, most still too raw to revisit. There's no substitute for not having him at my feet when the time comes to plan my next day's radio show or write my weekly column, but my life was greatly enhanced every day of those 16 years that Winston was at my side. I never had a dog growing up. My father was supportive, but my mother held a veto that she exercised throughout my childhood, although she too came to love Winston. He was, as I described, my first dog, but certainly not our family's last. In fact, there was a time when under our roof we had 4 kids and 4 dogs, or, as I like to say, 10 beating hearts in one home. Checkers was our white lab, and she lived a full life to age 14 and a half. Mr. Lucy is our miniature dachshund, who is at my feet as I type this. Floyd, a companion dachshund for Mr. Lucy, met an untimely demise due to my lack of awareness when driving my pickup truck out of our driveway one weekend. The thought of that day still pains me. Over the years, many have asked how Mr. Lucy got his name, and I want to share that story here. Mr. Lucy was a birthday gift from me to my wife in honor of her 42nd birthday. Her birthday is in December, and this one came just months after the tragic passing of one of our close friends, the Honorable J.C. Waldman, a federal judge based in Philadelphia. So now you are wondering, why would you name a dog Mr. Lucy for a man whose name was not Mr. Lucy? Fair question. First, let me tell you a little bit about Jay. I met J.C. Waldman when I was a summer legal clerk at the law firm of Dilworth, Paxson, Kalish & Kaufman after my first year at Penn Law. I was the lowest man on the firm's totem pole and spent most of my time performing rudimentary legal research. J.C. Waldman, on the other hand, was arguably at the top of the totem pole, having just joined the firm as a partner after leaving his post as counsel to Pennsylvania Governor Dick Thornburgh. I think it says a great deal about Jay that he was open to a friendship with a person who was then so far from being his professional equal. Politics was the initial basis of our relationship. We both craved political action. His experience was at a much higher level than mine. Over time, we became very close. Jay left this earth on May 30, 2003, after a valiant battle with cancer. His passing left many of us devastated. At the time of his death, he and his wife, Roberta, were two of my wife's and my closest friends. We ate together on a weekly basis for the last 15 years of Jay's life and vacationed together as well. In fact, it was Jay, in his role as a federal judge, who married us in a surprise wedding in 1994. We'd invited all of our friends to a party we billed as an engagement affair, but at 10 p.m., Lavinia, my wife, went into a changing room and put on a gown, and when she came out, we shocked the crowd by having Jay preside over the surprise ceremony. He was a brilliant man. Jay, we like to say, was able to see around corners. That's why his political and personal counsel was always in demand. Not only was he Dick Thornburgh's right hand, including during the Three Mile Island scare, but he was also Rudy Giuliani's longstanding confidant. The two knew each other since their days as young prosecutors in the Justice Department, and I think we can credit Jay for Rudy's first run for mayor as a Republican. I don't rely on Jay in saying this. I rely on Rudy's recollection as presented in his book, Leadership, published in 2002. At the time of his death, Jay was a United States District Court judge, having been appointed by Ronald Reagan, who had been appointed to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals by President George W. Bush, but not yet confirmed by the U.S. Senate. In an odd but appropriate twist of fate, in 2004, President George W. Bush nominated Paul S. Diamond to the federal bench, effectively enabling Paul to fill Jay's position. Paul Diamond was also a former Dilworth partner and one of Jay's close friends. Paul used to be a frequent guest on my radio program on legal matters because of his acerbic wit, but decided to stop doing the shows when he realized he might one day require Senate confirmation, and what plays in Morning Drive might not play in the hallowed halls of the U.S. Senate. Too bad for me. He was a great radio guest, and I would always introduce him as my smartest friend. J.C. Waldman's send-off was quite an event. I had the privilege of serving as the master of ceremonies. Those who eulogized Jay included Governor Dick Thornburgh, Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and Senator Arlen Specter. Another speaker was a friend of Jay's since childhood, a lawyer named Daniel Shapira. Believe it or not, this is where Mr. Lucy comes in. Danny Shapira is a gifted orator. He stood in front of a packed funeral home auditorium and told poignant and humorous stories about life with Jay. One of the best concerned a childhood poker game involving a young Danny and a young Jay and an old-timer in their neighborhood named, you guessed it, Mr. Lucy. I couldn't do the full story justice here, and I don't know that it's all that appropriate for me to do so either. What I do know is that Jay was the sort of fellow who liked to live life below the radar. For that reason, we didn't want to give our new beloved pet his moniker, but we did want to pay him tribute with our new family member. So to honor Jay in a style with which we thought he would approve, we decided we would call our new friend Mr. Lucy and think fondly of Jay when we are in his company each day. As Paul Harvey would say, now you know the rest of the story. Roger Waters, The Pinko in Floyd, Philadelphia Daily News, September 21, 2006. For the second time in my life, I'm writing a column about Pink Floyd, specifically about the man I've always considered to be the brains of the band, Roger Waters. The first time that I wrote about him was 26 years ago, When I was a high school senior at Central Bucks West in Doylestown and editor of the school paper, The Chatterbucks. Back then, I was one of the lucky few to see Pink Floyd perform The Wall live at the Nassau County Coliseum on Long Island, New York. My review earned me an invitation to the principal's office. I was encouraged to write a retraction on the grounds that I'd promoted a band whose lyrics the principal associated with drug use. It was a moment straight out of Another Brick in the Wall Part 2. We don't need no education, indeed. I told the principal to pound sand, maybe even called it a matter of free speech. For three decades, The Floyd has never left my playlist. In fact, I've done what I call the cycle for every Pink Floyd and Roger Waters recording, meaning I bought it in all forms in which it was released, album, 8-track, cassette, and CD. I once made a London taxi driver take me to the Battersea Power Station just so I could photograph the image that appears on the cover of my favorite album, Animals. No one was more pleased when the band reunited to headline at Live 8. And in the never-ending debate among Floyd fans on David Gilmour versus Roger Waters, I've always sided with Waters. My affinity for Waters has always been in spite of his politics. Chalk that up to spending too much time studying song lyrics back in the day when they printed such things. I thought rock stars had all the answers. Fast forward 25 years. Last Wednesday, I sat in the front row for a Roger Waters performance at Madison Square Garden. The same show came to the Tweeter Center in Camden Saturday night. The crowd was diverse, but mostly like me, middle-aged white guys with receding hair and expanding waists. It should have been a night to have a few beers and enjoy the soundtrack of my life. Instead, I sat there in my expensive seat and heckled the guy whose music I know by heart. Waters' politics are no longer just liberal, they're over the top. I was expecting the line about incurable tyrants and kings when he sang Fletcher Memorial Home, and I knew there'd be references to Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. What I wasn't prepared for was a photo montage featuring Osama, Saddam, and George W. Bush, especially not 2 days removed from the anniversary of September 11 in the city where the most death and destruction occurred. I'm sick and tired of entertainment types arguing a moral equivalency between our president and the butcher of Baghdad and the architect of 9/11. It's not that I object to the criticism of the president or his policy, but Waters and others lose all credibility when they treat Bush and Bin Laden the same way. And that was before Waters announced that he was beginning the controversial part of the show. I held my breath as he introduced Leaving Beirut with a long-winded story about his teens. And then came, are these the people we should bomb? Are we so sure they mean us harm? Is this our pleasure, punishment, or crime? Is this a mountain that we really want to climb? The road is hard, hard and long. Put down that 2x4. This man would never turn you from his door. Oh, George, oh, George. That Texas education must have effed you up when you were very small. This is Waters' ridiculous ode to some guy who gave him a lift and a meal when he was hitching in Beirut at 17. According to the logic of the lyrics, because he received this courtesy, we're supposed to overlook the murder of innocents at the hands of radical Islam, including the close to 3,000 who died almost 5 years to the day and just blocks from where I was hearing him sing. I couldn't take any more. Go visit Ground Zero, I shouted from the front row. He heard me and proceeded to avoid our corner of the stage except to oblige a hottie who wanted to take his picture with her cell phone. And then the pig came out. I refer to a giant inflatable pig, a hallmark of many Floyd shows, and the symbol of my aforementioned favorite album. Only this time the pig was a billboard for Waters' twisted priorities. Habeas corpus matters, it said, among other things. How appalling. I wondered how many in the New York audience had lost relatives or friends in the 9/11 attack and now were witness to his call for more rights for the murderers. Go visit Ground Zero, I yelled again. Roger Waters still has free speech rights. Bald, bespectacled, and willing to shell out for a front row seat? So do I. Time for another mea culpa. Roger Waters toured North America in 2017, during which time I had the opportunity to spend a few hours in his company and came away with a more nuanced understanding of his thinking than I'd gleaned from the front row. Of course, he would say that only means I hadn't been paying close attention all those years I'd been listening to him and reading his liner notes. Before hitting the road, Waters was interviewed by John Perales for a New York Times Times Talk in Midtown Manhattan. Waters is on the verge of releasing a new album, Is This the Life We Really Want?, and embarking on the tour he dubbed Us and Them. He showed